Accession number 30419, rail 11.
So we were going, what I was going to ask was just about, we glossed over actually learning to fly the Argosy. So I just wondered your sort of first impressions of being up in the Argosy.
And learning to fly the Argosy.
We talked about ground school, but we didn't talk about the actual process of the new plane.
Well, that's right. Well, I think that the simulator had taken the edges off, at least. The simulator, it was a very good simulator. It was one of the, I don't know how many there were around, but it was a very good introduction to the aeroplane. So you knew where all the levers and knobs were. You'd learnt all that, and switches. Actual flying of the aeroplane, it was bigger than anything else that I'd flown before. Four engines, 115 foot wingspan, I think it was, and and these wonderful engines. If I hear a turboprop these days, it takes me right the way back to Argosy times. You can hear turboprops at the city airport in London. They have the Fokkers that fly in and out, and they've got similar sorts of engines. And they make this tremendous sort of whistling, whining noise, but with a throb in it as the pitch changes on the ground. And you can hear that in the aeroplane. They make lovely noises. Not for the Residents Association of Thorny Island, but of Hayling Island, sorry, which is next door. But for us, it was a thrilling noise. So you've got that, and of course, starting up the engines, that's the first noise there is. Before that, you go through all the checks. That's reassuring, actually. That's good. You'll have seen on the films, in the RAF films, people reading checks and responses to checks, and it's part of flying. It's part of flying in a crew, and it's almost like sounds a bit fanciful, but I suppose like a bedtime story. It's reassuring in that respect that you've got the drills laid down. So as long as you're going through the checks, you're doing things right. And the navigator reads them out and you respond. Permission to start the engines. And then you start them one by one. There's a crew chief, ground crew chief, plugged in with a headset into the nose of the aeroplane. So he'll be in communication as you start the engines. There'll be a ground power supply plugged into your aeroplane as well. On the Argosy, you've got something called the Airborne Auxiliary Power Unit, which you start on the ground. It's basically a small jet engine in the boom turbine, which starts up and gives you auxiliary power. But wherever you can, you plug in the power from the mains when you're starting up. But that's very useful because it means you can start your bootstrap yourself, in computer terms, when you're at an airfield which doesn't have the facilities. You've got a power unit in the tail, one of the booms, which will give you enough power to start your engines. And it's a very quiet affair. The electric motor drives the propeller around. Takes a bit of getting going because it's a lot of mass in a propeller, so you've got to. It takes a while to wind up, but then when it starts to wind up to a speed with the electric motor, so the fuel starts to pump into the combustion chamber, and then the ignition comes on, so the fuel then lights up and starts to drive the prop itself, and so on, until the electric, it's going fast enough, the electric motor is thrown out by centrifugal force on the dogs, as they call them, that link it in, and the engine's then running on its own power. And you wind it up to a certain RPM and warm it up. Then you do the next one. So you've got this sequence of four engines coming to life and winding up to this wonderful note. I say wonderful note, it's made us all deaf. We were flying with very lightweight headsets without the realization at the time that it was interfering very much with our eardrums, this high-pitched whine. And I'm not so bad because I only did one tour on them, but a lot of my mates are stone deaf now. The cumulative effect of flying turboprops and then mostly helicopters afterwards, they were terrible, the helicopters, for your ears. Anyway, it sounded nice at the time.
And how long would that take? How long would it take to get all the engines up?
Three or four minutes an engine. So a good quarter of an hour to get started up. I suppose if you were really in a rush, you could do it less than that, but you'd allow enough time, generally, to start your engines and get them warmed up. Then you check all the systems are working, again, still on the power from the engines, because they now turn off the auxiliary power unit, unplug the ground unit, say cheerio to the ground crew chief, and make sure that everything's working autonomously without any external power. And you call for the... before you start your engines, you have to call the tower for permission to start engines. First thing the co-pilot does. And then you call for permission to taxi, and wonderful business of taxiing, because as you open the throttles and increase the power, so the pitch on the propellers changes to be able to cope with this increased power, so it grabs the air, and it's almost, you get this sort of vroom sound as you're taxiing, and it's unique to turboprops. I still like that sound. I like to fly from city or airport if I can, because you get that there as they turn on the runway there, and you get this vrooming as you're using the engines to turn you. Taxi out. It's a bit of a waddle in transport airplanes. I mean, if you're taxiing out in a jet plane, it's very smooth, like driving a sports car. But if you're driving a four-engine transport, especially if it's got a load on, you've got to be a bit careful. Take it slowly, take it easily. If you've got a crowded dispersal, you've got to watch those wingtips and remember that you've got a lot of fuselage behind you, which you can't see from the cockpit. You can see the engines and the wingtips, but you can't see the rear of the aeroplane. Twin booms on the Argosy, so it's quite wide. And you drive it off to the takeoff point. That's some airfields, that's easier than others. In Thorney Island, it's quite straightforward. It's a small airfield, but if you're in Saigon in the Vietnam War, which we were, then you've got to watch out for all kinds of things going the wrong way. And they can also be bumpy. You can get some unmade-up strips. We used to go into Brunei, for example, where it was a reinforced grass strip. So you didn't have a taxiway. We used to go to... in Labuan, there wasn't a taxiway. You used to taxi down the air... the runway. So taxiing could be quite exciting. Takeoff, brakes on, the captain, you ask for permission to take off, of course. Having given that, you then captain opens up to full power, checking the temperatures and pressures, and you've got four temperatures and pressures to check. The engineer, of course, is checking them. The navigator is still reading the takeoff checks. The navigator will have set his Doppler to zero as we take off. he'll have set the altimeters and you've got your heading, your first headings fed into the flight system. So now it's just a question of opening up the throttles, checking that all your engines are at full power, releasing the brakes, and you roll forward. Now the Argosy had a series of, it was a Class A aeroplane, which meant that it could lose an engine at any stage of flight and continue. But there was you didn't want to, if it was a certain, if you hadn't gone too far in the takeoff run, far better if you lost an engine to cut the throttles and stop. But there was a point on the runway, which you worked out, where the point of no return. And it was the co-pilot's responsibility to call out the speeds, so the captain knew whether it was he was past the point of no return and would continue the takeoff. Takeoff, I suppose, at about 100 miles an hour, and ease back on the stick. The control column on the Argosy is a nice, fat, friendly control column, shaped like a buffalo's horns, and you ease back on that. You haven't got any power controls, but you've got servo tabs on the control surfaces, so they go in the opposite direction to the way the control surface is going and give you just that little bit of help in moving the control surfaces. So it's quite a heave to heave it off. You're keeping it straight on the first part of the takeoff run by nose wheel steering. You've got a nose wheel steering wheel just on the captain's side, if I remember rightly. And then you transfer to the rudders for takeoff. Rotate at the call of rotate at the speed that you're supposed to rotate. If you're doing a tactical takeoff, which means you get it in the air as soon as possible, that's a very exciting procedure, because you don't wait until that safety speed to rotate. You rotate as soon as you're above stalling speed.
Stalling speed.
Where you wouldn't lift off. And then you fly level along the ground, building up speed. That gets you off the ground as soon as possible. You've got water methanol boosting in the Argosy, which means that at takeoff you're chucking into the fuel water methanol, which gives the more mass to the airflow through the engine and boosts the power. It also knocks seven shades out the engine if you leave it on for too long. So, but you use that for takeoff and for emergency power when you're in flight. So when you're airborne, climbing away, you cut the water methanol, you ease back on the revs, for climbing revs, and climb away. You take the flaps up, that would be the co-pilot's job. Oh, before anything else, he'll have taken the undercarriage up, of course. As soon as you can after takeoff, undercarriage up. Co-pilot pushes the button, big responsibility. And then clear up the flaps and climb away. It's then fairly straightforward, except that the thing about the Argosy is that it's built to flex. And I found this very disconcerting all the way through, that if you're flying something like a Hastings, which is built like a brick-built shithouse, if you pardon the expression, it flexes a bit, but the Argosy's got twin booms and this long high wing, and it everything wobbles about. So it's a bit like if you sit on the ground floor of a London bus, it's all very smooth. But you sit on the top floor, that's right. So in the Argosy, it's like sitting on the top floor of a London bus, even in the smoothest conditions.
So quite a lot of motion.
A lot of motion, and I found this disconcerting, to say the least, especially in a tropical storm. I mean, you really thought the aeroplane was going to fall to pieces. They never did, but the Bristol freighters did, and the Hastings did. I mean, tropical storms used to destroy aeroplanes. So, but they didn't the Argosy. So actually, it was a good thing it was flexing. It's built to flex, and that takes up a lot of the energy of the turbulence.
It's like earthquake houses built to
That's
move
right.
in earthquakes.
That's
yeah.
right. But it was quite disconcerting, and then the rest of the flying en route. You, as I say, you did this cruise climb to altitude. You then, when you came to come down, you tried, depending upon where you were coming, if you were under control of an approach and local, such as Saigon. Saigon was hell on earth. It really was, because through the 60s, the American presence was building, and you could get a fleet of 100 helicopters take off in front of you, or you could get a jet fighter come screaming in an emergency landing, and you just had to really just plough on through it and hope for the best. So it was quite often very exciting talking your way down through an approach. But if you were going into Labuan, for example, which was a base on an island north of Borneo, you could do a constant power approach. You were probably the only person coming in there, which meant that you tried to cut your power at the top of the climb to a level where you could just get a steady descent, and then cut the power as you came over the threshold. I never managed it, but some guys reckon they did. And the landing, pretty straightforward. You just let the speed drop off until the control column was so far back that you were in the right position just to ease onto the runway. But then when you got onto the runway, you had this wonderful moment where you threw all the propellers into disking. So you put them all to zero pitch. Four little levers, cha-chong, and you got this wonderful vroom from the air, from the propellers as they went into a flat disc, and that stopped you pretty quickly. If it was a tactical landing, you came in over the threshold just above the stall and stalled the aeroplane onto the ground as you put the props into disc, and you could stop the aeroplane very, very quickly. There was a 1,000-yard runway at 3,000 feet runway at Cebu in Borneo, where it was the only way to land. Tawau in Borneo, the only way to land. And you then kept straight on the rudders, and when the speed came down far enough, then you transfer to the nose wheel steering and vroom your way back to dispersal.
Shut everything down.
And then there was that, you heard the propellers, the props wind themselves down. I remember now there was a clicking. There must have been some kind of ratchet affair that you got this clicking coming in, and the clicking slowed down until they stopped. All clamber down the steps and off to put in the report. You always used to file the navigators would file their flight logs, and we'd file your radio log and go to the mess for a drink. There you are, that's what it was like flying the Argosy.
That's pretty good. I'm just trying to think. So, just break.
Righto.
So, next comes Borneo.
Yes. I've now spotted that we finished at Thorny Island on the 27th of July, and we knew we were going to Singapore, 215 Squadron in Singapore. Now, we didn't know a great deal about why, because the unpleasantness with the Indonesians was kept pretty low profile. But we did know that they had a lot of armaments, and we did know that they were being very aggressive towards the new, to be formed Malaysia, which was formed in September 63. Sukarno, President Sukarno of Indonesia, wanted to form Mafilindo, which was a federation of Malaya, the Philippines, and Indonesia. And he reckoned he had a pretty good chance because the Americans were on his side. The Americans had helped Sukarno chuck the Dutch out of Indonesia. They were still there in East Timor, but they were practically gone. And the Americans had a real variable attitude because they wanted to keep the French in Indochina against the communists. And therefore they supported the French there. But they thought that Sukarno was a good bet against the communists too. And he was. He slaughtered 100,000 of them. So they wanted to let him take over Malaya and the Philippines. Americans, of course, were the colonists themselves in the Philippines. But they could see this was a good chance to get it off their hands. And they were extremely suspicious of the British and their colonial ambitions. And they saw Malaysia, which was a proposed federation of Malaya and Borneo and the British Borneo states and Singapore, as being the Brits wanting to continue to be colonialists. And there was quite a lot of diplomatic work had to go on. So Sukarno reckoned he had a pretty good chance. He had a nation of millions, 100 million, I think, something like that. And they were all... He used to get 100,000 people out at a rally. He grabbed power from the Dutch after the Second World War. So he was being pretty belligerent, and we knew that he had a lot of armaments. He had 100,000 in the army. He had umpteen aeroplanes, American Mitchells, some of which had been given to him by America, others from the Russians. He had Russian Bears, and he had MiG fighters. He had a huge navy and aggressive intent. And we were going out to fly unarmed freighters floating around the jungles of Borneo. Well, mothers and girlfriends were a bit worried about this.
Were they? What was the reaction when you told them you were going?
My mother was sad for two reasons. Number one, she was very ill. I didn't at the time realise how ill she was. She had terminal cancer. And she had set her heart. She had thought she was going to be perhaps housekeeping for me when as I was pursuing an Air Force career. My brother had just got married, and I was going, and obviously keen to be going. So that was a bit tearful. And she was in hospital when I went. My girlfriend. I think she was, in fact, she had just decided she was going to get one of the £10 passages to Australia, and she went off on the Canberra about the same time as I flew off to Borneo. So that was all right. That was neat and tidy. My car, the Morris 8, the roof came off as I was going down Horndean Hill on the way to Thorney Island, so it was about due for the scrap heap anyway. And that was all the responsibility I had. So I went off pretty carefree. We got on a Comet at RAF Lynham one morning, and quite a lot of the various squadrons, but some of the families which were on our squadron. I remember John Horsfall, for example, one of the young captains. It was his first tour as a captain. He'd done one tour on the Beverly as a co-pilot. He had a little girl of three, and his wife was pregnant. I remember them being on the aeroplane because the little girl was sick all over John Horsfall's shorts, and he borrowed a pair from me. He was half my height, so it looked a bit strange. Well, not quite half my height, but you know what I mean. So it was quite an interesting flight. We went to Aden, to Gan. It was four stages in the Comet then, and it took 24 hours, and we were pretty dishevelled by the time we got there. It was like a flight through the old British Empire, because we went to RAF stations and places that are now meccas of oil riches and in the Middle East were then just tin shacks with RAF guys manning them. Gan was interesting. I mean, there was Bob Scott's York, 100 feet short of the threshold. It's a little island in the Maldives, and
yeah, I haven't heard of it.
Yeah, and it was a staging post for the Far East. Everybody, it was very, very busy because the airplanes then didn't have the range to get right across the Indian Ocean. So we all used to stop at Gan, and the miniskirt was coming in. It was 1963, so the ground crew at again, I remember them being quite amazed by the shortness of the girls' skirts. And off to Singapore. Now, Singapore was an extraordinary place. It hadn't changed at all from days of empire. It, of course, fallen to the Japanese during the war, but after the war, the Brits just took up where they left off. And the local population didn't show any signs of minding about that, because it brought order where there could have been chaos, and the British respected local beliefs and customs and culture. Whereas this is why there was so much trouble in Indonesia. The Dutch didn't. They imposed the Calvinist faith and the Dutch way of doing things. But the British were very sympathetic to local, well, that's the way it seemed, and that's the way the history books have been written, and I reckon it was the thing which won us that particular conflict, because the people were on our side. The people in Singapore wanted Malaysia to happen. They didn't want to be taken over by Sukarno. Singapore was only a small island. It's about 7 miles by 4 miles, and I can't remember the population then, but it was pretty crowded. Had 1, 2, 3 RAF bases, a naval base, and umpteen barracks. It was a fortress. We went to Changi, which is on the eastern tip of the island, and it was the airfield with it was the place with the infamous Changi jail. Which was still there, operating as a jail, and very evocative and macabre sort of place too, and an airstrip which was built on a swamp by the prisoners of war. The story was that the prisoners of war had built the airstrip the wrong way to confuse the Japanese, and certainly it was crosswind and into a hill, and there had been another airstrip built which was north to south, or northeast to southwest. Just right, the monsoon blows for 6 months in one direction and 6 months in the other direction. So the airfield that the Brits built for the Japanese certainly wasn't the easiest airfield to fly on. There were all the gun emplacements still there that had famously been infamously been pointing the wrong way when the Japanese attacked down the peninsula. And all this, of course, Kathy, had happened only a few years before. This was 1963. It had fallen 20 years before, just about.